Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And together with co-hosts Emery Roan and Mike Keyes, we're joined by Lindsay Cook today. You data mavens are going to love this show. We're going to talk about how Apple Watches are used mostly for health data, how rich kids' Instagram accounts are used mostly to get their parents in trouble, and how animals are used mostly for selfies, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 342, recorded April 15th, 2016. Chim Chim Canary. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We're thrilled to be back after a week off last week. And we've got an incredible panel. Data mavens in the audience are going to be so happy because Lindsay Cook is back on the show. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. For folks who don't recall, Lindsay has been with us before. She is U.S. News and World Report's blogger, one of their bloggers at Datamine. She also has this incredible newsletter. If you're not already subscribing, you really need to subscribe right now. Drop what you're doing or wait till after the show if you'd like. Go over to Tiny Letter. We'll put a link in our discussion points exactly where you need to go. But the newsletter is called Up, Down, and All Around. And you send these out maybe once or twice a week, Lindsay?
Yeah, it's really as often as I can, but once or twice a week usually.
Yeah, just great, quick hits of data-rich information on things that have gone up, things that have gone down, and things that are just otherwise interesting to you, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So it has a section for things going up and things going down. For example, like down teen pregnancy, up cybercrime.
Great. Can I be happy about one of those and not so happy about the other? Is that okay?
Yes, that's fine.
Yes. All right, good. Also joining us this week is Emery Roan. Hello, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Sorry, I was just signing up for Lindsay's tiny letter. It's as always, great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Need to do that. Emery is a 2L at California Western School of Law in San Diego. He's focusing there on internet law, cybersecurity, privacy, and digital civil liberties. And for folks who have been regularly tuning into the show, Emery is our intern here at This Week in Law. And he's also been co-hosting with me for the last few months and has agreed to stay on as co-host now for, I don't know, what did you say, until like early next year, maybe life is going to go out of control on you?
Until you literally kick me out. You have to come down to San Diego and physically kick me in order for me to get off of the show.
Oh, well, we'll have to make arrangements for that. It's not too far down the road. But I have no plans to physically or figuratively kick you at any time. So wonderful to have you back. Wonderful to have you co-hosting. And also joining us once again, Mike Keyes has been on the show several times recently and was very kind when I reached out to him and said, Mike, I'm having so much fun having you on the show. Could you please come back on a regular basis and co-host the show with me? And Mike has agreed to do that. So yay, great to see you again, Mike.
Thank you, Denise. Great to be here with you and Emery and Lindsay as well. I'm looking forward to it.
For those who are not already well familiar with Mike, he's a partner with the Dorsey Law Firm in Seattle and sometimes Palo Alto as well, correct?
That is correct.
And also one of the bloggers at the Dorsey Firm's The TMCA blog, which stands for Trademark, Copyright, and Advertising. Great source of information on all kinds of stuff that we regularly discuss on the show. So wonderful to have you back, Mike, and wonderful to have both Emery and Mike co-hosting the show with me. Yay! So exciting.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. So with Lindsay on the show, what I'd love to do when Lindsay can make the time to join us is to comb through what she's been pointing to lately and find things that I think are good jumping off points for our discussions here on the show. So I've done that in several instances prepping for the show this week. And the first little hit of data that I thought would be interesting for us to start on is it's been a year, I think it was April 10th, that the Apple Watch was introduced. So let's talk about the Apple Watch and what we know a year later. Of course, the Apple Watch is just one jumping off point into the world of wearables and how people are using wearables. And the particular bit of data that I got from Lindsay's newsletter was that a year later, after the Apple Watch has been in people's lives, is about 80% of folks who are using the Apple Watch report using it a lot for fitness and health tracking. Is that right, Lindsay?
Yeah, that's right. So most people who are using the watch are using it to track their health, so track their steps, track how long they're standing, very similar to what we're seeing with the Fitbit and Jawbone products.
So the Apple Watch obviously does more than just the fitness tracking, but I think it's pretty interesting that despite all of its various other Swiss Army knife type functionality, the fitness thing seems to have risen pretty definitively to the surface.
Right. And I think that's very similar to kind of what we saw with the iPad, where maybe when it came out, people didn't know quite what to use it for. There wasn't as large of a community of app development around it. So what we saw is kind of people saying, oh, I know what a fitness tracker is. This is a fitness tracker. I'll use it for that. And then kind of using it maybe to see incoming calls and stuff like that. So there definitely is a lot more that Apple, a lot more of a market share that Apple needs to tap into. It hasn't seen the same adoption rate as fitness trackers. It costs a lot more than fitness trackers, obviously, but definitely a missed potential there.
Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing in the articles about the year anniversary of the Apple Watch is just its level of penetration in the population. I was kind of surprised to read that something like 5 or 6% of the U.S. population has an Apple Watch. That seems awfully high to me. It's a lot of people. It's over 12 million people.
Of the people polled, though. I think the polling size here was, I think, 2,500 American adults. So of that percentage, of that people, I think they said nearly 77% of people wanted it. Or yeah, what was the number? Yes, some really surprising number of adoption. I was surprised as well.
Yeah, it just seems, I don't know. On the one hand, it surprised me. On the other hand, just anecdotally, my mom mentioned she was at the doctor the other day and her nurse had an Apple Watch that she was monitoring something on. So, you know, I see them fairly commonly, but I think California, you have to kind of take with a grain of salt because we jump at these things that come from Silicon Valley. I'd be more interested to see how commonly you see them in other less California exposed areas of the country. Let's talk about the fitness component, though. I'm curious whether any of you, A, have an Apple Watch, or B, have a different device that you're using to monitor your fitness with. Mike?
I do not have an Apple Watch. The closest I came to it is my youngest daughter was really hitting me up to purchase one for her so she could, I guess, more readily access her music and some of the other entertainment functionality. So I don't have an Apple mm-hmm. Watch. My son does have a Fitbit that he regularly uses to track all of his workouts and various and sundry other endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay?
Yes, I have a Fitbit. My brother has an Apple Watch, so I would say I have played around with one. But yes, I have a Fitbit, and I wear it mostly every day.
All right, and Emery?
I do not have a Fitbit or an Apple Watch, and it's really unfortunate because I am exactly the kind of person that, you know, I'm going to be first in line for the cybernetic upgrades. I am the target audience, but, the privacy problems just kind of scare me. I want a wearable that communicates between the wearable and my phone or the wearable and my computer. You know, I want smart devices. I'm tired of devices that are just internet connected devices to smart services. And yeah, that's where I stand on the matter is as soon as they get some devices that, you know, just communicate with my computers, then I'll be happy to wear them. The closest thing I found is a sleep tracking app on Android that is one of the few sleep tracking apps that only uses the information on the phone and keeps all the information siloed on the phone. But yeah, I'll be first in line once they fix that.
Right. Well, that's the big issue with these yeah. devices, right? Oh, and just so I can chime in on this too. Last month, my brother and sister-in-law gave me a Jawbone, which I, for reasons such as Emery was mentioning, I had held off on doing any of the fitness tracking devices until one landed in my lap as a gift, and I decided to try it out. And having used it now for more than a month, I really like it. And
yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it would be.
I love the idea of light tracking. It's, mm-hmm. it's exact. You know, if we could have exact, you know, no quantifiable all the information about our lives, we can make better decisions. I totally buy that 100%. But again, it's the data is not protected at all. The EULAs are frequently anti-consumer friendly. You know, the list goes down. But one
right.
day.
Well, I'm going to preview one of our resources of the week. We have a couple of others that we'll talk about at the end of the show. But in prepping for the show, I stumbled upon an article at wearable.com that's titled, "We Read Your Wearable Text Terms and Conditions So You Don't Have To." And it goes through really lots of the devices, the Fitbit, the Apple Watch. What else do we have here? The Oculus Rift.
Yeah, that's a big one. I actually wanted to talk about that too.
The Xiaomi Mi Band. I'm sure I'm butchering that. The Garmin products, the Jawbone that I'm wearing, something from Under Armour, and the Pebble, and Google and Android Wear, Samsung, and it's got their terms of service and privacy policies all summarized for you, up to, you know, however up to date those things are. Some of the policies haven't been updated in a couple of years. But if you're curious about how these companies can use your data when you're using their devices, this is what you need to read. And it's a great resource from wearable.com. What were you going to say, Emery?
Oh, I was just saying, you know, the Oculus Rift, virtual reality is my other super nerdum. And for people that have been following that space, Oculus, now owned by Facebook, has sort of been in the news in the past couple of weeks for some controversy coming up over their EULA. So virtual reality is, you know, these headsets that you put on and you have controllers that are tracked and it lets you sort of be in the video game. And a lot of people are saying that this is the year that that finally takes off. But Oculus's EULA made waves because it says that Facebook has the ability to track and store your body motions, which as far as, you know, tracked personally identifiable data is, you know, sort of a whole new ballgame. It's not clear. They've said that they aren't using that currently. They're not currently tracking your data and or tracking your movements and using it for advertising. But they could potentially do that in the future. And yeah, I see some people in the chat already saying, oh, what do you mean? They're just tracking our body motions. That doesn't sound that bad. And I've seen, you know, people on the internet saying the same thing that, well, and, you know, if we're looking at this next to the vast amount of other kind of data collections that are going, it seems pretty innocuous. But I do think it's warrants a little bit of discussion. At least, you know, the privacy person in me would love to see more general discussion about the implications of giving companies not just our purchasing habits and our spending habits and our web traffic and our connections and our contacts and everything else, but literally knowing exactly how we physically move in our house, how we physically interact with things, what we're looking at on the internet. The idea that, you know, with tracking your head motions, it could know exactly what object you're staring at on a digital shelf. Or exactly, you know, who you're looking at or what part of a person you're looking at when you're looking at them. And all this information is just sort of a new class of information that is, I think, inevitably going to be collected if Oculus is allowed to, which is, you know, it is what it is. It's I'd love to hear what everyone else thinks about it. But I think it's worthy of discussion at least.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so wide open right now. There was a piece recently monitoring, I think it was diabetes apps that were available in the Google Play Store. And unsurprisingly, something like less than, I think it was 19%, 18 or 19% of them even had a privacy policy.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
The Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, the nonprofit that I also work at, before I got here, I think in 2014, they did a little study looking at the top fitness and health tracking apps on Android and iOS. And they found something astounding, like 40% of them didn't have privacy policies at all. Mm-hmm. And whether you're free or paid, it's just like terrifying. And, you know, in the wearables discussion, that's these fitness trackers are the gateway drug to getting biometric tracked information. That is, you know, Americans, we like our fitness, we like to run, and we like to track that information. And, you know, it's sort of opening the door to this whole other host of biometric information that isn't necessarily for your doctor or for your health provider, so it's not covered by HIPAA, but is incredibly valuable and is incredibly personally identifiable. Yeah, it's a brave new world.
Well, President Obama spoke at South by Southwest this year and was wearing a Fitbit when he did so, and was mentioned, I guess, that his has actually been manipulated by his government staff to make sure that the president's health data is not in some unsecure and hackable location. So his has been tailored to his privacy needs, but that sort of leads the rest of us out in the cold, unless they're being as cautious as Emery mentions. There probably is a market for devices that do this and really plug the fact that, hey, we're not going to anonymize your data and share it and analyze it. We're going to make it private to you and useful to you only. Lindsay, I'm wondering if you have seen any kind of discussion or data or studies about people's comfort level with how their health data is being used by fitness trackers?
Sure. So I have seen a couple of studies of people's comfort level when they give information online, and it's pretty frightening that people, especially younger people, are not worried about handing over their information, no matter what that information is. So they'll give their location, they'll just, you know, click allow very easily on the iPhone when it's saying, can we track your location? I think it's kind of, if you grew up with technology, you were kind of raised in this atmosphere and raised not to question it. And going back to even the privacy policies, it's not even just Apple and Samsung and Fitbit and all these companies. It's also the apps that you're connecting to and all of those apps that have access to your information. And, you know, you selected allow, you could be giving them something that you don't want to give them. And I think we've also seen that it's fairly easy for a computer scientist or even an undergraduate computer scientist to then reverse engineer that data and identify you. So nothing that, you know, claims that it's not personally identifiable, most of that can be identified. So that is also scary.
It is. And really the only reason I decided to bolt on the thing that I got as a gift and use it is the mental calculus I went through is, well, you know, if I'm tracking, and by the way, I think it's interesting to discuss what the fitness trackers pick up just from you wearing them and what you have to actively input into the app in order for them to give you really textured information. This thing can't tell what I'm eating. Oftentimes it can't tell what sort of activity I've engaged in. Sometimes it can catch that I have been active and it wants me to tell it what I was doing. So we can discuss that in a moment. But the calculus I went through was, well, do I really care if you know, somebody gets into this database and they know how many kombuchas I'm drinking a day? Probably that doesn't much matter. How often I do yoga. I'm not that conscious of that information. But if you tilt it slightly and consider the pros and cons of sharing that kind of information with commercial entities such as your employer or your insurance carrier, that's when things get pretty interesting. And some of the stories that we have in our discussion for the discussion points for this week consider those two issues in depth. One is the whole notion that employers are incentivizing employees both with wellness programs that sometimes involve fitness trackers, sometimes involve not just, you know, making it a condition of their employment, but which I think is problematic, and some companies have taken PR hits for that. But if you make it just a wonderful perk, you know, you're going to get a great bonus if you're participating in this wellness program and wearing a Fitbit in part of the process. I could definitely see people wanting to jump right on that. You know, why not? I'm getting healthier and I'm getting paid. Sounds like a good idea to me. And the same thing, and again, it's the younger people who really seem to be all in on, hey, you know, at some point in my life, I'm going to want life insurance. And if I buy it when I'm young, it's going to be cheap. And if I'm healthy and providing them data that shows that, I'm going to get even better pricing on it. So why not? I'm all in. Mike, do you find these kinds of attitudes interesting, problematic? What do you think?
Yeah, I find them very interesting. I think for millennials and for folks of that generation, everything seems to be so free and open-ended. They seem far less concerned about sharing personal private information online or elsewhere. It's also interesting. I think this is a really good example of the law and social and public policy trying to keep up with technology. I mean, here we have technology racing along at a very fast clip. I think the law is really trying to catch up to it in a lot of respects. I know in some of the material that we were looking at for today's podcast, you've got federal regulation at the HIPAA level when it comes to certain types of wellness programs that are offered through an employer's health insurance program. But then some of these aren't regulated if they're offered through a third party of some sort. So it seems to be a very, I don't know about convoluted area, but it's certainly, there's all sorts of issues emanating from it. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, particularly as this technology continues to evolve. I mean, in 2 years from now, who knows what the Jawbone's going to be able to track, right? Maybe it'll be able to track a lot more than what it does today, which will no doubt be the case. So it's going to be a constantly evolving area, it seems to me.
Right. One of the things I stumbled on in reading through all these resources on this topic is a portal that the Health and Human Services Department in the United States has for companies who are developing in this area, even though the regulation is kind of wide open and HIPAA may not apply because we're not talking about medical providers gathering data here. But notwithstanding, the Department of Health and Human Services has this portal for sort of best practices, even in the absence of any express regulation that controls. So if you're in that field, definitely check that out and make sure you're approaching this by doing the right thing. And you're not in that data set of folks who don't have a privacy policy and all the other stuff that makes us cringe. One thing I was interested in finding, I mentioned how you have to input a whole lot of stuff to augment what the tracker is able to pick up about you. If you want it to help you lose weight, for example, it needs to know what you're eating. If you're going to use it as a weight loss device, so you have to put all that in. It needs to know what activities you're doing. And I remember the one distinction that I've noticed between this and like a dieting app I used years ago when I was trying out every app because we were all app crazy when the iPhone first came out, is that the diet and exercise app that did not involve a tracker but just relied on you to input everything, wanted you to input everything, including every form of activity that you've been engaged in, including intimate, personal, romantic forms of activity, which at the time I thought was just hysterical. And I've noted that Up has declined to have a default for your bedroom related activities as something that they're going to track.
If you're wearing it, though, it certainly can pick up your heart rate, you know? I know people that don't take their Fitbits off ever. I would imagine it's got a lot of information about exactly who and where and when, you know?
Well, and that was the other thing is last week when we were off, I was traveling. And when I got back, the app gave me a little reminder, hey, we see you've been traveling and we see you're back now. Don't forget to get back into your routine. Well, how did it know I was traveling? I get apparently GPS is involved and they know where you are.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah. And then in terms of that too, just to give another example, I don't know if you guys saw this, but on Reddit, someone posted on the Reddit Fitbit thread saying that his wife's Fitbit was broken. And eventually they figured out that it was not broken. She was pregnant. And they were able to just diagnose that she was pregnant just from the fact that her Fitbit had her heart rate higher than normal. So imagine if your company saw that and it's you've been pregnant for a week and now your company knows you're pregnant. I mean, there's definitely a lot of privacy concerns. And just like we said about the bedroom activities, if Fitbit doesn't know these things, if these health trackers don't know this yet, they're only going to get smarter. So they're only going to learn more about the data as time goes on. So if you're wearing it now and 3 years from now you decide it's 2/1984 for you, they still have your data and they can still you know, go back to that and use what they've learned over the last 3 years. So definitely a lot of concerns about increasing technology there.
Yes.
I definitely think it's also worth, we can move on, but I was thinking that in the show notes, we've got some links to some articles that are talking specifically about employers using, Fitbits to incentivize their workers to be healthier for insurance benefits or what have you. And, you know, just what Lindsay was saying, that's, terrifying. There are, businesses that are, will say that, we'll give you a Fitbit for $50, and people don't understand that store of data is worth far more than $50. You know, your health insurance or your business, your employer are not giving you these things out of the goodness of their heart, and they're not collecting this data just because they can. They're collecting it because it's valuable, and they, it's a zero-sum game. They want they're getting a gain out of it. And the article has some horror stories about these services that are specifically designed to look at not just the Fitbit, but all of this other information and build profiles about employees for employers. And they will do things like automatically send out emails to employees about health information. Or if an employee gets especially, sick or something or pregnant or whatever, because it's not HIPAA protected data, because it's provided by the employer, the service can then give that information to the employer. Which I'm sure, you don't have to have a crazy imagination to see how that could go horribly wrong. Lots of privacy issues here. It's a very privacy-rich news week. And as soon as they get me a Fitbit that just communicates on my LAN, I'll be happy.
Yep. Yeah, the notion that your employer would know that you are pregnant, possibly before you do, certainly before you've gotten yourself geared up to tell them, I could see that.
Yeah, and where we don't have it. Yeah. Without mandatory parental leave, these employers might be making their own rational decisions made, So,
right.
Yeah.
All right, Mike, any last thoughts?
Nothing here.
All right. Let's move from our wrists up to the sky. Oh, first we should maybe insert our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in the show in case you are a lawyer or other professional listening to the show for a professional credit. We think that the stuff we discuss on the show is very educational and topical and worthwhile and knowledgeable. And if you're a lawyer, you have to stay on top of legal developments in various areas. We have some information for you if you are engaged in that practice as a lawyer. It's at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. And we've got some information for U.S. lawyers on that front. We're happy to help out in any way if you need us to give you. Sometimes I find people need to have those attendance certificates filled out, even though I think a lot of people do this as self-study. If we can help you out, just give me a shout at denise@twit.tv. We're happy to do that. So our first passphrase for the show is called Fitbit birth announcement. So jot that down. We put these phrases into the show in case you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened as opposed to just wrote it down on a list. So let's move from our wrists up into the skies. This is something else that Lindsay had in her newsletter or possibly in her Twitter. I can't remember now. But this is about, it's a BuzzFeed piece about aerial surveillance in the United States. Lindsay, let's start with you on this to tell us what exactly you learned from this piece.
Sure. So BuzzFeed did an analysis of flight patterns, and basically they found out that there are FBI and DHS aircrafts that are circling particular areas. Sometimes they have cell phone devices on them that work like a cell phone tower where they can intercept your cell phone signal. There's concerns that Muslims might be being targeted by these aircrafts. So definitely some gray area with surveillance aircraft that we do not know are in the sky, but maybe collecting information about us, what you can see, as well as information through the airwaves and Wi-Fi waves.
Right. So we think about spy planes possibly being over other countries, not so much over ours, but increasingly you can see why they might be. How exactly did BuzzFeed get this information? Where did the data come from?
I'm not actually completely sure. Oh. I think that they got it from the FAA. Mm-hmm. Looking through it now.
There's a website called Flight Radar 24 that has publicly available flight information for all flights. So this is a really great example of awesome investigative journalism using open data. Mm-hmm. You know, this is stuff that the EFF, that the ACLU north of Northern California, a couple other people have talked about before. The idea that the FBI is flying over American cities with stingrays on their planes to spoof cell towers, to do surveillance over neighborhoods. You know, we've heard that, but this BuzzFeed article, which, by the way, I was only slightly disappointed there weren't more GIFs. But this this BuzzFeed article,
it's very GIF heavy.
Yeah, really went into the meat of it, and they did their research and expanded on the findings of the EFF. They found that the FBI has over 100 fixed wing airplanes, more than a dozen helicopters that they're using, that it, just in the 4 month period that they were studying, had more than 1400 flights. And that's pretty bizarre. You know, the idea that when you think of, you know, everyone likes to think of the spying as like an NSA purview with, you know, drones being flying way above, you know, the stratosphere and using high, you know, whatever, super high quality cameras to spy on middle, you know, countries far away. But no, this is just a bunch of Cessnas flying very low to the ground with some good cameras. You know, it's expensive, but not that expensive. And yeah, when we're looking about how these flights are going, we're seeing them circling over mosques and we're seeing them circling over specific neighborhoods. You know, this is information like when we're not to get like put on my political hat or anything, but when we're hearing rhetoric in, you know, the race to the White House 2016, and then we see that we are already have the FBI totally okay with flying, you know, surveillance circles around mosques and, you know, specific Muslim neighborhoods or Somali neighborhoods. It's pretty scary. This is a great, really great article. I highly recommend everyone check it out.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And actually the GIFs and graphics, unlike many BuzzFeed articles, are really, really informative.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
opposed to simply, you know, entertaining with cats. So it's quite eye-opening. I don't know that I'm necessarily not okay with it. You know, I mean, as long as they're operating within the law and not, you know, we're talking about, I suppose I was about to say, we're talking about people out in public, but this would track you wherever you are. If you're in your home, it would track you there too. If they're using stingrays to get your cell phone to connect to them as though they were right. an actual cell tower. So I could see where there could be some Fourth Amendment concerns here, but, putting on my idealism hat and thinking that there could be a way to do this and honor people's Fourth Amendment rights, I'm kind of excited to see that the government has this level of sophistication. I don't know that the first part of my premise actually can play out though. Mike, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, I was very surprised to see this was so extensive, and to look at some of these flight patterns, particularly after the San Bernardino attacks. I thought it was pretty fascinating to see. I'm with you, Denise, though. I'm not so certain that I'm frightened or think this is appalling. There's all sorts of government intrusions that I think have been happening for a number of years, some of which have made their way all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So mm-hmm. I'm not so certain that this is awful or frightening or terrible, but it frankly, it was surprising to see how prevalent it was.
Mm-hmm. If I could chime in just quickly.
Sure, of course.
I think that especially if you read this article, it's clear that, at least according to the FBI, that they're using these for causes that certainly seem justified. Sex trafficking, murders, drug trafficking, gang violence. My fear is that, it's not necessarily the use today, it's the use tomorrow. What we're seeing here is, the practice being normalized that we're okay with the FBI sending up planes, all day for 5 days a week, because apparently they don't work on weekends if you read the article.
it's the government after all.
But, the worry is I watched a great documentary on Nova a couple years ago about drones and their surveillance capabilities. And one of the things they talked about is the ability that once you have planes above a city flying regularly, you just do that as a regular practice with high quality cameras, then you can essentially time travel whenever anything goes wrong. So my worry about that, this is quite literally the eye in the sky, Big Brother fear, where eventually we just have these planes flying all the time every day on our major cities. And if anything happens, or if any protest happens, or if a journalist who says X, Y, and Z against whoever is behind the button that controls the FBI planes, sorry for shaking my screen there, I don't like the slippery slope argument, but here especially, I think that it's worth considering that down the line, do we want the police or our government to be able to just press a button and pull up a complete, record of what's going on in the city and be able to zoom down to the individual and follow them through traffic and, know exactly who they connected to and map that network out? Personally, I think that's a little scary, but mm-hmm. It's certainly technically sophisticated. And according to the article here, it has secured, hundreds of arrests. So it's a discussion worth having. I would personally just like to see more transparency about this. I hate that, we needed a BuzzFeed investigative article after multiple watchdog organizations have been saying this and getting no coverage for months before we know this for fact, mm-hmm. What if a public official proposed this even, and we could talk about it, but instead we just have eye in the sky.
Right.
It seems to me, Denise,
go ahead, Mike, in
some respects, this aerial surveillance is maybe even a little less intrusive than some of the video cameras and other such things you see on street corners these days. Mm-hmm. Here in Washington, in various cities here, Seattle, Spokane, you've got all sorts of cameras and other things that are monitoring people's daily activities. So I'm not sure that aerial surveillance from a mile above is any worse than what's already going on right now.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that suspects can be tracked pretty readily, even without planes in the sky, just based on the other cameras and surveillance that are out there and operating already. This just seems to be another piece of that puzzle. And
they're bricking the wall. No argument here, but
I think the biggest difference for me is that with a street camera, you can a lot of times see the street camera. So you mm-hmm. don't necessarily have as large an expectation of privacy. Whereas with one of these planes, they do have mufflers on them where you can't hear them, where maybe you can't see them as much, or even if we are approaching drones, which it seems like this is going in that manner, you might not be able to see it at all. It might be really small. So I think that is a difference. And then also the transparency piece. For example, these planes were used in Ferguson, Missouri. We don't know why. If we looked at a street corner video, that's something that could potentially be available under the Freedom of Information Act. You can see that. You can know it's there. You can get it. Whereas with one of these planes, we don't know why the plane is there necessarily. We don't know what it's capturing. We don't know how to get it. So it's definitely less transparent.
Yeah, definitely. In a moment, we're going to stay on our topic of information that the government is gathering, either on its own or indirectly through companies. In a moment, we'll talk about Uber's recent transparency report. But first, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is FreshBooks. Small business owners, it's time to be honest about how you feel when dealing with your day-to-day administrative work. Admit it, you can't stand it. It's a total grind. The truth is, over 5 million small business owners feel exactly the same way until they discovered FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the dead simple cloud accounting software that's transforming how small business owners handle their paperwork. With invoicing, you can use FreshBooks to create and send an invoice that literally takes about 30 seconds to create. There are no formulas or formatting, just perfectly crafted invoices every time. With online payments, your clients can pay you online. You don't have to wait for them to mail you a check. It often means you end up getting paid, of course, a lot faster. With project deposits, there's this super handy deposit feature so you can invoice for a payment upfront when you're kicking off a project. And insights. FreshBooks can even show you whether or not a client has looked at the invoice that you've emailed. This is only a fraction of what FreshBooks can do for you. You owe it to yourself to feel the full effect of FreshBooks on you and your small business. Also, check out their EMV chip card enabled card reader. Getting started is simple and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, Uber. The headline on this from TechCrunch was, Uber shared 14 million users' info with the government, transparency report says. What I think a fairer headline would have been giving Uber a kudos for issuing a transparency report, and along with Twitter and a number of other technology companies actually letting people know, Microsoft, various others, Google, of course, let people know what sort of requests they're getting from the government and how much information they've turned over. And so Uber is the latest to do this. 14 million users' information was disclosed to law enforcement and regulatory agencies, according to its report. Most of that consisted of ride information for more than 12 million users. So here's the government trying to get information on its investigations from how people are riding around in the world in their Uber cars. What do you think of this, Emery?
Oh, I thought it was a great read. You know, obviously, this information is going to be tracked. You know, when we're talking about problem areas on applications, the example that is always brought up is that, oh, well, you know, if I open Uber on Tuesday and then don't close my phone until Friday, Uber has been open the whole time. And, you know, ostensibly all that information is tracked. And, well, yes, it is. And it's very valuable, obviously. I think that if you read the actual transparency report, it's pretty interesting. Going down the list, a full, like, almost 20% of the requests were from airports. So obviously, it's clear to see why the government would be very interested in tracking drivers and rides from airports. And with airports, 100% of those requests were fulfilled. They do actually go down and provide granular information about how many requests were fully complied with or partially complied with, or how many requests they were able to negotiate down. You know, transparency is great. I agree that, you know, Uber probably needs to be given a little kudos for releasing transparency reports. Ideally, in a perfect world, transparency reports would just be required by either the organization requesting the information or the businesses whenever the requests are made. But yeah, this is a great step.
Right. Emery raises a great point that, of course, lots and lots of other businesses turn information over to the government all the time without telling you or anybody else about it.
Yeah, let's not this is not at all. Uber gave 14 million reports to, or 14 million customer information to the government, right, and Lyft did not. No, I mean.
Right. Transparency reports are good and help you understand exactly how your data that you're putting into these apps can be used. An interesting point too is that Uber now has a warrant canary. We talked about that several episodes ago when we had Declan McCullough on the show. A warrant canary is a statement somewhere. It's either in the report or elsewhere on the website saying that as of the day that was published, Uber has not received a national security letter or a FISA court order. The reason warrant canaries are important is when they disappear, then you can go ahead and assume that the company has received such a letter or FISA court order, which requires them to cooperate with the government without telling anybody about it. Mike, any thoughts on this?
Just seems like it's a tremendous amount of data that was shared with these various law enforcement agencies. I mean, I'm 14 million different users, many of which in places I suspect people would logically associate with some of these requests were a lot coming out of California and some of the other major metropolitan areas. So very interesting as to what's going on with all these requests and how exactly this information is being used. I can understand, Emery, as you were referencing, a lot of information related to Uber driver and rider activity at airports. But outside of that, it's interesting.
Yeah. We're seeing them in California, Chicago, and New York City in particular are the highest centers, according to the data that they provided here, with almost 6 million of the requests coming from California alone, and another 2.8 million requests from New York City alone. So a full 50% of the total requests are from, you know, all of California and New York City. So interesting.
I found it interesting. Go ahead. Tell us about the warrant canary.
I just wanted to chime in. I'm not sure if we covered it last week or the week before, but you know, Reddit made waves because their warrant canary was conspicuously absent. Sorry, from their 2015 transparency report. Mm-hmm. So as of a couple weeks ago, at least we know that the warrant canary system works, and that we can be confident that Reddit has received a letter.
Yeah.
So. Not to derail the conversation.
No, not at all. The other thing I found really interesting about this, in sort of the similar way, I found the usage stats on the Apple Watch and other wearables interesting. It's just the penetration of Uber and how many people have made it routinely a part of their lives. I guess I'm less surprised about that than I am about the wearables. I mean, Uber just seems to be ubiquitous. Lindsay, are you on board with that? Do you see it everywhere?
Oh, yes, definitely. But I think it's also important to recognize that even though you see it, it's so common, especially if you live in a big city, like I live in Washington, D.C., it's still very easy to re-identify me in that data. So, for example, if I'm taking Uber every day or every other day or twice a week, to or from work, it knows where I work. It knows probably where my apartment is. And just with those two pieces of information, you can very easily re-identify someone. And that's definitely of interest when you consider how unsecure your data is and how prone to hacking it is, especially when it gets into a lot of these different hands. So definitely something to watch out for there.
I think that's actually the crucial point that is frequently ignored. And like the elephant in the room is that like hacking data security is really, really hard. And I don't think that anyone has shown themselves able to be worthy of being trustworthy holders of our data like this. It doesn't matter how big or small the organization is. You know, everyone is just as vulnerable to spear phishing because you're just as strong as your weakest link. And so, yeah, the fear is not necessarily like so frequently it's like, oh, I don't mind if this company or even if the government has this data. But we're not talking about that. It's when you have all these huge, valuable stores of information, they just have the biggest red target on it. And if it hasn't happened already, it's going to happen eventually where that information is going to get into someone's hands that you would not like it to, most likely.
And certainly those hacks are so common. I mean, I had my information hacked and the government hack, the large one that happened like 6 months ago, a year ago, where I had my fingerprints, my social security, all of that.
Biometrics.
Stuff.
You can't
imagine
unlock your
if
phone
they
securely.
Had all of your health data and all of your Uber data in that hack. I mean, that would be crazy.
Yeah.
So what was the upshot of that, Lindsay? Do you feel like the government took adequate steps after that happened? And have you had unforeseen consequences?
I have not had my information. As far as I know, nothing has been done with my information. They sent out a letter letting people do credit monitoring. But I do think that once your information is out there, it could be years. You really have no idea what could happen with it. So,
yeah. All right.
I think that according to a conference I just went to, the government offers something like 3 years of, identity protection. Identity theft protection. But then you're thinking, well, that's the whole reason why people are stealing biometric information. It's because you can't revoke it. And so you're going to see organizations that have these massive, when we're talking about data breaches in the millions, of course they're not going to jump and use the data that they just grabbed last week. They're going to hold on to it and wait 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, it's still going to be equally valuable. And that's the real fear is that, yeah, we have not seen a lot of these data breaches come up on the black market yet, because in all likelihood, they're probably just sitting on them and they're still valuable. So super scary stuff out there.
Yeah. And Beatmaster in IRC is mentioning HTTPS, of course, haveibeenpwned.com, P-W-N-E-D, as a resource to check out. Do you know anything about that, Emery?
I've heard it.
Run myself through it.
Yeah, I've heard it before. It came up, Security Now was talking about it a couple of years ago. It's a great resource. I haven't dug into, the organization behind it or how extensive their data breach database is. But yeah, essentially what it lets you do is you have a very simple platform where you can go in and enter in your email address, and it will tell you if your email address has come up on any of the massive data breaches that we have access to. Looks like my email address is still safe for the time being.
Right. I mean, probably your email address is not something that I think a lot of people would be necessarily worried about, right? It's a pretty public thing. If your email address is out there, that doesn't necessarily mean it's been
the accounts that are tied to your email address. So for example, actually I put in another email address and I have been pwned in the Gawker breach and a couple of other breaches. So I'm not safe.
I see.
Sorry.
Gotcha. All right. Let's move on and look at some Hollywood action. Another great bit of data courtesy of Lindsay's newsletter is the extent of investment in new media digital kind of companies by old media entertainment companies, basically trying to – the way the Hollywood Reporter characterizes it is the tangled web of power players' investments in the outlets stealing their audiences as corporate conglomerates place bets on content's murky future. So there's just this great infographic there that the Hollywood Reporter put together showing you investments by people like Univision in things like The Onion, or people like Disney in things like Vice. Fascinating to see these ties, sort of reminiscent of AOL Time Warner from back in the day. Lindsay, you want to shed some more light on this?
Sure. So if you look on the graphic, you can just see that a lot of these companies that we think of as startup media companies, they're actually being backed by these old world media companies, the very ones that they're stealing their subscribers or stealing their readers. So I think it's interesting. It's I think it also speaks to just the business culture that we've created and the fact that it's very difficult to launch a successful media company without this type of money. It's very hard to compete in the marketplace. And we're seeing that with other industries, obviously, as well. So it does make it hard to totally find new players that are not being bankrolled. And I think it does create situations with advertising that makes it hard to change on an industry from an industry viewpoint.
Mike, from let's take the A out of the TMCA blog here, advertising disclosed or other otherwise undisclosed backing. Does this raise ethical concerns, disclosure concerns for example, people like Mashable to, as they're covering Time Warner, make mention of that?
You know, Denise, I might defer to Emery on this one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Emery, what do you think?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question? I was in chat.
Sure.
So sorry. The worst handoff ever.
You're more than welcome to be in chat. I'm just wondering about the ethical and disclosure concerns for people like Mashable, who, you know, in the news now has investments from Time Warner, Tribune Media. I think those are the only two that are reflected here on this graph anyway. But these are outlets that may well come up in their reporting, may well come up in their advertising or feature in their revenue structure other than just the pure investment by the company. And I'm wondering what you think about the delicate line they have to walk there as far as disclosure and credibility.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction on the article was, you know, what, the old media giants have managed to carve up the new media? Color me completely surprised. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, I certainly think that if we're talking about ethics in journalism, that is a much better hat to hang your, much better place to hang your hat than, you know, video game journalists or whatever the Gamergate nonsense is that continues to broil on the worst parts of the internet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, knowing which journalists' websites are funded by the major old media giants would be great. I'm trying to pull it up right now, but there's the classic infographic that shows that like all media companies are owned by like four companies, or like all companies are owned by like four companies. So, you know, I'm not surprised. I think transparency would be better across the board and everything. So, yeah, report who owns your company. Maybe have a big label right at the bottom of the website.
Right. And it raises a concern for me because, you know, some of these new media journalistic outlets are so good at what they do. You know, BuzzFeed, we will always sort of joke around with whether you're looking at a cat GIF or something really solid like the piece that we saw on aerial surveillance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they sort of have it all, but I don't know that they necessarily have the grounding in journalistic and legal requirements as far as what they need to do with this kind of information.
I see it as a way
that people can definitely open mouth, insert foot, or worse.
I don't know any of the legal requirements for like reporting requirements for journalists or news articles. Is that something that, Lindsay, you might know a little bit better on?
So, there is the code of ethics, the journalism code of ethics from the Society of Professional Journalism, which is the main code of ethics that journalists subscribe to. There's obviously no licensing for journalists, so you don't have to. But if there is a legal case, that is one of the things that courts and judges tend to look at, is if you were in line with this code, if you were in line with what, you know, normal or the average journalist would do. And it does say that you should disclose funding sources. But I think that also we're dealing with a code of ethics and an, you know, changing industry that has not completely caught up to the new media wave of thinking. So we're seeing, for example, a lot of unknowns for ethics around Instagram or video embeds or advertisements that look like their content or other sources of funds even. So it's definitely an ethical gray area and one that journalists are grappling with right now. But I definitely think that transparency is always favored.
All right, let us move on to something musical. We've covered this before on the show. I believe it was in the context of a summary judgment that was partially granted in the case, but there has been some litigation going on involving the song Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin. If our younger viewers haven't heard of Led Zeppelin. It's no doubt going to be subject to some kind of resurgence soon, if it hasn't already. I noticed that Guns N' Roses is playing at Coachella this year, so I'm not quite sure what that all means. But if you're not familiar with Led Zeppelin, you're probably familiar with their most famous song, Stairway to Heaven, and the guitar riff that starts it off is just kind of iconic. There is a band called Spirit. Was a band called Spirit. I don't know if they still exist and are still recording, but they are suing and saying that Led Zeppelin actually copied that riff from them. Mike, you put this in the show. Tell us what the current posture of the case is.
Sure. So the case was brought by a fella, Randy Wolf is his name. I think he was the former frontman for Spirit. He's no longer alive. So the case was brought by the representative of his trust or his estate. And of course, as you mentioned, they're suing Led Zeppelin and a bunch of the folks involved with the distribution of Stairway to Heaven for copyright infringement. So this is a dispute that's kind of been percolating for a number of years. As a matter of fact, the plaintiff, Randy Wolf, was interviewed for a magazine back in the early 1990s where this was brought up. And he said something to the effect that, look, if Led Zeppelin wants to take the beginning of Taurus, which is the song that's at issue, you know, I'll let them do it, or something to that effect. So, of course, Led Zeppelin has used that statement by Mr. Wolf to say, look, not only is there no infringement case here, but even if there was, he essentially is foregoing any claim against us as a result of releasing us from any claims from that 1990 interview. That's just one of the many issues involved in the case. So what just recently happened is Led Zeppelin moved for summary judgment. And the court denied the summary judgment motion, said that there's issues of fact, and there's a lot of issues of fact here. And so the case is currently set to go to trial there in Los Angeles federal court on May 10th.
What I found pretty fascinating in reading the coverage of the case and the issues that are still going to trial is the whole notion of trying to pin down whether Led Zeppelin would have even been exposed to the lyrics, or not the lyrics, but the riff in question. And this whole notion that there's evidence about the two bands performing together at the same venues and Robert Plant hanging out with the Spirit guys. And it's just injecting this whole intent element, it seems like, into the copyright consideration that I'm not used to seeing in copyright cases. You know, either you've copied something or you haven't, and you pretty much can tell that by looking at the works of art side by side. Why is this different, Mike?
Well, I think it's a little different here because one of the elements in a copyright case is you've got to show access. You've got to show that the purported infringer had access to the work at issue. Mm-hmm. And of course, this goes back to the creation of the respective songs at issue. You know, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and the other folks in Led Zeppelin are saying, look, we didn't know this song. We didn't have access to it. Yes, there may have been overlapping tour dates and we may have interacted with these folks, but we didn't have access to it. We don't remember the song. We don't really remember these people. And of course, on the other side of the V, the plaintiffs, or at least Wolf's band members and some of the other folks are saying, of course you did. You know, Jimmy Page, I think, was on record. No, it was Robert Plant is on record saying that he was a friend and liked the band Spirit. So that's really one of the issues where the court said, look, there's an issue of fact here as to whether there was access. You know, we're going back and trying to figure out what happened 40 years ago, and people's memories are hazy and murky, and there was some interaction between the bands, and that's ultimately for the jury to decide if there was access here.
Okay, well, it's always fun, like was true in the Blurred Lines case, to actually, I think everybody kind of knows what Stairway to Heaven sounds like, so we're not going to play that, but we'll play a bit of the Spirit song that is at issue here, and you can judge for yourself how similar you think they are, Victor, if you could cue up those couple of little bits. I mean, obviously, you could see that that's pretty close if you're a Zeppelin fan at all. Or, yeah, I don't know how you've lived in the United States and not heard Stairway to Heaven at some point in your existence, but I suppose it's possible. My kid may not have. But there's more to it than simply being similar or inspirational, isn't there, Mike?
There's far more to it here. And I think anybody that would compare the two would say, yeah, they sound alike. Mm-hmm. But that's just the beginning of the inquiry here. So one thing that's particularly important in music copyright cases is to assess whether this particular musical element is original. And there's a very good article written by Alex Ross in The New Yorker. It's called The Unoriginality The unoriginal originality of Led Zeppelin. And what Mr. Ross says is, look, this what's called a lamento basso, that little descending bass line of the guitar, it's been around for centuries. And the picking guitar sound, the picking harmonics, that's a very typical type of musical element that's used all throughout. Recent history and old history. He also cites some interesting songs that have very similar harmonic elements to them. Think of Hotel California by the Eagles. It starts off and it has that very same descending chromatic bass line. Chim Chim Marie, for those of you that would be familiar with the Mary Poppins musical. And there's various other songs that have this very similar type of harmonic, this harmonic style to it. So, you know, I think that's going to be one of the central defenses for the Led Zeppelin team is, look, this is something that's been in existence for centuries in music. And no one can say that they've got a corner on the market when it comes to this chromatic descending bass line and guitar.
What did you say it was called? A something basso?
Basso lamento.
Basso lamento, of course, is our second passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Thank you for that.
A spelling on that for our listeners that might not.
I'm going with BASSOLAMENTO.
You got it, Denise. Perfect.
Yes. Basso lamento. That's not going to help you out too much for the twill drinking game. I'm sorry, because that involves Latin, and I'm guessing this is Italian.
Forgot about
it's
that.
It's a Latin language.
Right.
It's a romance language.
Right. So, yeah, I'm so glad that Mike is here to provide that music theory background because, yeah, it was my understanding that music, in particular out of the arts, sort of builds on the shoulders of giants. And, yeah, it sounds like exactly what – I'll hand it over to Mike. You were continuing. Sorry.
No, Emery, I think you're exactly right. I think out of all the art forms, music is unique in that respect because you literally do build on the shoulders of giants. So if you go back – if we go back to, the Romantic, the Baroque periods, classical music, I mean, Bach borrowed, Beethoven did, Brahms, Rachmaninoff, they all borrowed from each other. It was something that they were all proud of, quite frankly. You know, music lends itself to that. You know, you look at, take our national anthem, for example, very powerful melody. You know, that wasn't written by Francis Scott Key. He, of course, came up with the words to it. But that music itself comes from – it's an old British tune. So all throughout music, we see things are borrowed. It's one of the many reasons I think that the whole copyright structure when it comes to music should be overhauled.
Oh,
But that could be a subject for a complete other podcast, I suppose.
or fodder for Lindsay for her newsletter, as somebody does a study as to how many guitar riffs go back to hundreds or thousands of years of musical history, right, Lindsay?
Yeah, it's a good idea. Take that.
All right. We're already talking about copyright in the entertainment context, but let's talk about copyright in some other contexts. All right, I'm not sure how many weeks running we're going to be able to keep this up, but I do have an animal selfie of the week for you this week. It is not a living animal, unfortunately. It is a stuffed animal. Sam the dog in England was sent into space by an elementary school as part of a science project. Sam was being tracked by GoPro the entire time. And apparently, the GoPro was pointed at him in such a way that it, as reported, showing what looks like Sam taking a selfie with the world quite literally at his feet. So our animal selfie of the week for you would be little stuffed Sam. Do you think this adds a wrinkle to the whole animal copyright issue if the animal is not actually and has not ever been living, breathing, biometrically engaged in the world, Emery?
I just hope that there's some law student that's going to apply, you know, go to law school maybe next year, 2 years from now, who, having this great body of discussion, will write a really great paper about it. No, I don't think that this contributes anything whatsoever to the discussion. But
right, I don't think so either.
At this point, renew my request to our lovely dear listeners and viewers, mm-hmm. who, if any of you would like to make an animal selfie bed music or animal selfie animation for us to play, I'm pretty sure this is going to be a weekly feature. So yeah. You can send them to.
We'll see what the world gives us in this way. We didn't. The escaping octopus, unfortunately, did not have a GoPro attached to him at the time when he escaped, but he was all over the news as well. If it was a he, I think it was a he octopus. Let us go to, though. I get questions constantly, Mike, about. Well, so now can I use the happy birthday song now that the happy birthday lawsuit has been over and it was found that Warner Chappell did not actually own the copyright to the song? That doesn't mean that somebody doesn't, though. So, I mean, I don't know. How confident are you, Mike, that people can just happy birthday willy-nilly? I have seen more instances of it on TV in the wake of the lawsuit.
Right. I think you bring up one of the interesting wrinkles about the happy birthday case is that last fall, the court down there in California found that Warner didn't establish rights to the lyrics. And just to be clear, it was the lyrics that were at issue in that case. It wasn't the underlying tune itself. The tune itself has been in the public domain, I think, since the 40s or 50s, as I recall. But it was really just the lyrics that Warner licensed out and had made a pretty tidy sum over the years licensing the right to reproduce the Happy Birthday to You lyrics. So you're right. That case has been done. I believe that as part of the settlement, Warner paid, I want to say, like $14 million to the class to settle the claims regarding its licensing practices with respect to that, with respect to the lyrics. But yes, so technically, the court didn't say that the lyrics are in the public domain, but the only party that was really taking issue with other uses of it, that party no longer owns the copyright. We know that.
Okay. And now we have another lawsuit involving We Shall Overcome that's just been filed. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. So this was pursued by the same set of lawyers that were successful in blowing out the candles on the Happy Birthday to You lyrics. And so this is over the song We Shall Overcome, which many folks probably know that to be considered the unofficial anthem of the civil rights movement. It was copyrighted back in the 1960s by folk singer Peter Seeger and a couple of other folks, and ultimately a company that claims to own the rights in We Shall Overcome, which has also licensed that the reproduction of that song. Their claimed ownership of that has been challenged in this recent class action filing by the We Shall Overcome Foundation, which is saying that the claimed owner of the copyright in We Shall Overcome isn't the owner of it at all. This is in the public domain.
All right, so that's just been filed, and we'll have to see how it unfolds over time. So from We Shall Overcome to, I guess, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, we're going to take a little walk over to the social web side. So here's a good statistical nugget for you, Lindsay, that leading cybersecurity firms say they are using evidence from social media in up to 75% of their litigation cases. So the way this is playing out in particular is people are disclosing, obviously people have been disclosing things about themselves in embarrassing ways on social media for ever since social media has existed. But now what's happening is people tend to be pretty braggy on social media. And so people's offspring with money can sometimes post photos that are very detrimental to the whether it's tax fraud, asset hiding, what have
swear
you.
Those that bills are fake.
Yes, that their parents are involved in. It winds up being evidence that, gee, you seem actually to have assets that you did not disclose or otherwise. And it's all because the kids can't keep themselves off social media. Did you take a look at this at all, Lindsay?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's really interesting because of the concentration on the children. And we've seen rich kids of Instagram, rich kids of Snapchat, these sites that are dedicated to reblogging or sharing these crazy displays of wealth. And now we're definitely seeing how that can come back to bite you. And it's interesting, too, because I think that these children probably don't realize that their parent, this could end up bad for their parents. And the parents probably don't realize what the kids are posting. But we've seen that a lot of these Instagram celebrities are these otherwise unknown rich kids, and that it can definitely result in trouble, both in terms of assets and also geolocation has been used a lot to track properties and that kind of thing.
Yep, it's not too surprising to us on the lawyerly side of things. We'll take our evidence wherever you're willing to hand it to us. And social media is a great way of getting at that stuff when it's posted publicly. Emery, any thoughts?
Oh, it's just things like this that make me, you know, believe in karma. There was, you know, anything that possibly could be better than this. I'm not quite sure if I can think of it. For rich kids on Instagram getting their parents in trouble for posting their awful, awful narcissistic garbage online. Yeah, it hits all the points for me. It's great.
Mike, what do you think?
I agree with Emery. I got a real kick out of it, particularly the photograph that you displayed there, Denise, with 50 Cent, who had just recently filed for bankruptcy protection, posed in front of a stack of $100 bills spelling out broke. probably not the wisest thing to do if you've just declared bankruptcy.
He did say those bills were fake, which I guess if you film a lot of rap videos, whatever, yeah, maybe. But still, bad idea, guys. Come on. Clearly.
He's got a whole counterfeiting thing he's going to get himself in trouble with.
Yeah, exactly. True.
All right. Speaking of offshore accounts and things, let's talk about some policy and legislation kind of concerns. The Panama Papers. Law firm in Panama. What happened here? It got hacked, Lindsay?
No, it was a leak. A leak of just an insane amount of information. So much more than WikiLeaks, probably the largest dump of information ever. And it was all these financial records. So several journalism organizations teamed up to go through the records using text analysis software, machine learning software to identify names. And they found many politicians that were using these shell companies and also many ties to different countries. So far, there's been the Prime Minister of Iceland, I believe, resigned. And there's been some other resignations as well. So it's definitely hit hard for a lot of people and a lot of companies.
Right. So I think we have a little bit of predictive journalism on this that the studio has queued up. Life imitating art, perhaps. Let's see what we got.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't divulge information about that customer's secret illegal account. Oh, crap. I shouldn't have said it was a customer. Oh, crap. I shouldn't have said it was a secret. Oh, crap. I certainly shouldn't have said it was illegal. Ah, it's too hot today.
So I guess lawyers in Panama have been at this for a while. Emery, you found that wonderful little nugget.
thanks, Reddit.
Yeah. So I put this under legislation, regulation, and policy because of the tie-in to government officials who have had their embarrassing information made public here in much the same way, I guess, as private, very wealthy information are getting in trouble when their children are posting things on social media. Do we know anything about the leaker here, the motive? Was it someone within the law firm? How did this all come about, Lindsay?
Yeah, I believe that that part of it is still a mystery. I wouldn't be surprised if it became less mysterious over time, but I believe that is still a mystery right now.
All right.
There was some discussion that perhaps a government entity leaked the information in order to hurt another government entity. So we're not sure. I would say that all we have is conspiracy theories at this point.
Yeah. Right.
As long as we are talking conspiracy theories, I know something that has been conspicuously absent from most of the Panama Papers is an American presence. So it's led some people to suggest that it might even be some kind of CIA operation. The Bradley Birkenfield, who was the whistleblower that revealed the tax fraud with Swiss banking, I'm going to put that in the chat link right now. He was someone that suggested that, you know, it seems like to him that this is probably a CIA operation. But again, it's totally conspiracy theories. We have no idea, you know, the root of these right now.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Wild speculation. Never something we shy away from here on the show. Mike, any tinfoil hats you want to put on about this one?
No, I've nothing nothing to add.
Nothing to say at this time.
Not to put the tinfoil hat on too tightly. Sorry about that, listeners.
No worries. It looks good on you. another great tidbit that you found, Lindsay, had to do with judges' voting records and their potential for appointment to the Supreme Court. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. So it was a study that found that when a judge knows that they are being considered for the Supreme Court, so they know that they're on the short list for a Supreme Court nomination, that they are more likely to vote in favor or to rule in favor of the government and less likely to oppose them.
That's really fascinating. I mean, it's just, you know, a raw statistic, and obviously you can't draw definitive conclusions from it, but sometimes correlation and causation go eerily hand in hand, and this might be one of those times. Were you interested to see this, Mike?
Well, I was utterly fascinated to see it, but I don't know that I buy it.
Tell me why.
Well, I'm not sure that it seemed to me this study was focused on from the point that there is a vacancy until somebody's nominated. I mean, mm-hmm. that can be a very short window. Take, for example, just the most recent one. Justice Scalia died, and within a month, Garland was nominated. So is the point of the study that they looked at from the time of vacancy whether an appellate court judge was somehow changing his or her voting record or style? Because if that's the case – that's only during a month period. I don't see it. I mean, appellate court decisions, although the federal appellate courts are very busy, it's not like you can crank out multiple decisions within a month's time. So I don't know. It just seemed to me to be, like I said, utterly fascinating, but I'm not sure that I buy it. The other thing that seemed to me to be maybe a little bit suspect here is they did say there was some statistical analysis that was done, and there appeared to be in one or two instances a 8% differential between the two. And I don't know that that's necessarily statistically significant. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I noted that the authors didn't necessarily take a position on that issue. They just noted that there appears to be a statistical disparity.
Right. Lindsay, this is something that must come up for you a lot as you cover different studies and graphs and data points as to the, you know, what really you can draw from the fact that there are correlations that they don't necessarily always support what they seem to support.
Sure. And I think that with any study of this type, you kind of have to take it with a grain of salt and kind of look at the entire body of research around the topic. So I think it's interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily say that these judges are changing their vote either explicitly or implicitly.
All right. I think we can end the show with a little discussion about cheese, if that is amenable to everyone. One of my favorite things in the world, cheese.
I was really hoping that was bed music specifically for cheese and that we had just been hiding it.
Yeah, the cheese music, the trademark cheese music. I brought this up in the trademark context because one of our viewers/listeners wrote in that they had read this Forbes article about Parmesan cheese. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but Parmesan cheese has been much in the news lately because even the stuff touting itself as 100% cheese is apparently packed to varying degrees with other things such as cellulose powder, which is made out of wood. So folks are up in arms about this. And he writes, I read this Parmesan cheese article and he asks us to read it and pay special attention to the described attitudes toward the named trademarks. And then imagine what would happen if a Chinese manufacturer would make a tablet and call it iPad or make a car and call it Ford. So I'm going to toss this over to Mike and get your take on that question. Does the branding here matter?
So what was exactly the point of what he was saying, that there's all sorts of stuff that's inside of these various cheese brands that are unsavory or people wouldn't think of as necessarily being a cheese product? Is that what the point was?
Yeah, I think the point of this discussion is it's kind of an advertising and branding issue. Parmesan itself is not Parmigiano Reggiano as it comes from Italy, and of course there's a lot of branding around that. You cannot call your cheese Parmigiano Reggiano unless it is from that region of Italy. But the Kraft 100% Parmesan grated cheese that we find unrefrigerated on our shelves here in the United States and elsewhere, has some products in it that are not 100% cheese. Other ingredients that are added, I guess, to the cheese. It would be interesting from a food and health perspective to dive deep with a lawyer who's familiar with those issues into what you can and cannot say about your product and what 100% means. But
right. So setting aside, I guess, any sort of FDA considerations and looking at it from the perspective of the consumer, I mean, really the issue from a consumer standpoint is going to be, were they somehow misled or deceived into believing that they were getting 100% Parmigiano cheese when in fact they were getting something else? I mean, maybe that's the case, but it seems to me that the rank and file consumer that's picking up Parmesan cheese to sprinkle on their spaghetti at night isn't that informed as to the intricacies and niceties when it comes to Parmesan. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that that would be potentially a stretch.
What do you think about the idea that as far as, you know, consumer expectations, the names that they used to describe the cheeses were basically plays on the word Parmesan. So I'm reading from the article here, but such names as Parmesan, Parmigiana, Parmesana, Parmabone, Real Parma, Parmesan, Parmesano, and my all favorite, Parmesanan. Parmesanan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, Emery, that a consumer that's picking up this cheese is really going to be that educated as to where the cheese comes from, what are the licensing necessities associated with being able to use a particular name. You know, I think by and large, the vast majority of consumers want either something that's shredded or grated to be able to put on their pasta in the evening that somehow has the flavor and texture of some sort of cheese product. Again, I could be wrong, but that seems to me that that's really what the consumer's after here.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, Mike. And for those who really want the real thing, you know, you can't buy it off a shelf next to the spaghetti sauce. It's
Sorry, Denise. The other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, there's been a lot of litigation about what is 100% natural, and a lot of class action cases down in your neck of the woods in particular about what that means to the consumer, natural, 100% natural. And, you know, natural can be a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And a lot of those cases have not been successful because, at least in the class action context, because the courts have said, look, natural can mean different things to different people. And we don't have a unifying element in these cases as to what exactly 100% natural means. So it's just another issue I thought I'd raise.
Depends on
and this
what
brings
the
a tally of Italian goods that we can't trust too, right? I mean, wasn't it just last week or something or last month that we heard about like 98% of all olive oils that say they're Italian olive oils are not? I don't know. It's disheartening for someone that likes Italian food.
Well, and if we can't know what natural means, I have no idea what we're going to do with extra virgin.
Yeah. Very good point.
in various contexts. All right, let's move on to our tip and resources of the week. Our tip of the week comes from the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, and here on Tax Day is incredibly topical. I don't know if you've taken a look at it, Emery, but it is a wonderful list of things that you can do to help prevent yourself from being defrauded in the course of paying your taxes. So focuses on the mailing process for people who are mailing checks into their various taxing authorities, how you never want to leave your tax return or a check to the government laying around in your mailbox waiting to be picked up, etc. Anything that you want to add to the wonderful list of tips that's presented here or that you want to call out for us?
Yeah, I just want to call out in particular the scam characteristics section. Mm-hmm. So I'm personally a TurboTax filer. You know, I just think it's kind of easy. But what we still do see, we see complaints every day of people calling in about IRS scams. So watch out for IRS imposters. There's a section there. My wife actually just my cynical paranoid hat is saying that because my wife is a non-English speaker and that data has probably been sold to advertisers somewhere, she got this scammy call. But I know that my wife received a scam call from someone saying that they were from the IRS and that they owed that she owed a certain amount of money. So that happens all the time, especially to older folks and to non-English speakers. So just be careful of that.
Do you think you're more prone to having something bad befall your identity or your bank account if you're mailing in your check rather than electronically paying in one form or another?
I couldn't say. I've got no idea on that.
Yeah, I have no idea on that either.
Points of failure where that could happen, then, you know, there's more points along the chain where you could have it physically taken if you mailed it in. But right. At the same time, if you're using vulnerable, like weak passwords or, you know, bad OPSEC, then obviously there are just as many weak links of the chain on that side as well. Sorry.
Right. My dad was trying to tell me this morning how secure he feels mailing in his check. And, you know, I was trying to counter that using a government site is probably more secure and that his bank is probably more hackable than somebody else. But again, this would just be some of the wild speculation that we're prone to engaging in here on the show.
I would trust TurboTax more than any of them, to be honest. I mean, you know, a well-made website with a good host of technical support that is able to help you immediately online or on, you know, chat or phone, that like bank their whole reputation on this process. And the website is clearly using, you know, good HTTPS and all the proper things that you would expect. That would probably be, to me, I think the most secure way of doing it. But just because, frankly, if someone that's looked at a lot of government websites, I would not put more trust in the government website.
Gotcha. Lindsay, any tax thoughts or stats before we move on?
I do know last year, and I'll try to find it and put it in the notes, that there was several data points that a lot of these third-party apps are not that secure. Oh. So definitely...
I retract that.
Look that up. Concerning.
Sorry about that, listeners.
More things to fear.
All right, good. We'll put that in the discussion points. Whenever I'm referring to the discussion points, I'm referring to our page at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. This is episode 342 of the show. So that's the tag that you're going to want to look for to see everything that we've referenced here on the show today. And I'm about to reference two amazing resources, again, gleaned from the wider web courtesy of Lindsay. One of them is called FOIA Mapper. And this is the thing that you want to use if you are, for example, listener Jonathan, who was asking me between the shows here about getting... He was thinking about the FBI versus Apple story and the fact that lots of people are wondering if Apple's going to be able to get information on the OS, the iOS vulnerability that the government was able to get a third party to exploit. And he's wondering if they could get at that through FOIA. Well, my thoughts on that were that if something is classified, you're probably not going to be able to get at it through FOIA, and that I'm unaware of any causes of action might arise in Apple's favor because they made an OS that was capable, that had a vulnerability that let this happen. So I don't know that that Apple would be able to benefit from any of that. But if you wanted to find out if there was government information on that topic or others, you would go to FOIA Mapper and you would search for government information by keyword, see what other people in news organizations are requesting. So there are logs and all kinds of ways to get at information that is available because a Freedom of Information Act request has been made. Do you want to tell us anything more about playing with this, Lindsay?
Sure. It's really interesting. You can look by person, you can look by organization, you can search different keywords. One thing I like to do is see which requests have been outstanding the longest. So certain agencies are infamous for letting their requests go on for years. For example, the FDA, CMS, both of those agencies are definitely have some very long wait times. We have a reporter here who has been trying to get some health data for over 3 years. so you can look and see which requests have been out the longest.
All right. And then in a similar vein is Data USA, which really is a great resource and takes a bunch of stuff that would otherwise be hard to get to. It's all publicly available government information, but through this site makes it indexable by Google and also visualizes various data sets in different ways. Can you tell us a little bit more about Data USA?
Sure. So the precursor to Data USA is data.gov, which is a older site that's been up for a few years now, and it has almost 200,000 data sets. But it's very difficult to search through it. It's very difficult to visualize it. It's just it's not that user-friendly for someone who doesn't really know data. So this site is meant to be an improvement on that in that you can see visualizations right on the site so you can really glean more information off of a particular topic or a particular place without having data skills necessarily.
Right. It really looks like a fun tool to play around with. You can find things about your hometown, for example, that goes way beyond. Here's a great thing from the article. It goes way beyond just your population, statistics, elevation, things like that. It's going to give you some more fine-grained information about what the most specialized jobs are in that area, the most common non-English languages, what industries are doing well or not doing well city by city. So it's some really a cool entry into all kinds of data that's available and really, really interesting. So thanks so much, Lindsay, for always finding these great tools and resources and bits of information. You're always a pleasure to read and always a pleasure to have on the show with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Is there anything you want to let people know about that you're involved with, doing, speaking at, writing, other than what we've already covered today?
Sure. Just follow DataMine and definitely sign up for my newsletter and you'll get all the latest information.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us. Emery, great to see you again.
Thank you. As always, it was great to be here. Lindsay, thanks for that heads up about TurboTax. I'm doing some research now and kind of kicking myself, but I'm going to be out of the show next week. I think I'll be back the following week. So yeah, it's always a great time. If you listeners want to get in touch with me, you can reach out at Emery at twit.tv. Always looking for new show topics, guests, and bed music for cat selfies. So send them.
All right. And Mike, wonderful to see you too.
Thank you. Great to be with all of you today. Have a great weekend.
And you as well. And you can also reach Mike. Mike and Emery both have emails at Twit now that you can use. Mike at twit.tv, emery.twit.tv. I, of course, would be Denise at twit.tv. Please do reach out to us between the shows. Let us know what's on your mind, what you thought about what we've discussed, what you've read that you think might be a good topic for the show, guests you think we might like to invite on. We love hearing about all of that. Really helps us get the shows together for you week in and week out. If you're joining us, if you joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time this week to watch the show, that means you've been watching live as we record. That's always fun to do. We do record the show at 11 Pacific, 1800 UTC. So that's a great time to join us and play along live in IRC if you'd like to do that. If you can't do that, don't worry about it. You can always go to our twit.tv/twill page where the entire archive of shows exists. If you're a YouTube person, if you're an iTunes person, all of the various ways you can enjoy the show are described there on our Twit page. And they'll hook you up, whatever device you like, whatever atmosphere you like for watching to or listening to the show. You can find all the information you need right there. We're just thrilled that you join us every week or whenever you can, actually, and hope that you'll come back next week for This Week in Law. We'll see you then. Take care.